Greetings and welcome to the Closter Daily Times for Thursday, February 19th, 2026, brought to you by the Talking Information Center, located in beautiful Marshfield, Massachusetts. This is your reader, George Krein. Today's lead story, Lilly gene probe underway. Deep sea tech being used. It's written by Bobby Grady. A multi-agency investigation led by the Coast Guard is deploying deep sea sonar technology to create a map of the seafloor in hopes of finding the fishing vessel Lilly Jean, which sank suddenly last month with all seven hands lost. Local and state leaders, as well as representatives from the Coast Guard, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, and the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Police and State Police on Wednesday outlined what has already been done and what is being investigated and what investors hope to find. Making its return to port, the 72-year-old Lilly Jean sank January 30th, about 22 miles off the Gloucester coast, without making a mayday call. The Coast Guard was alerted by an emergency position indicating radio beacon, or EPIRB. Such beacons can activate without human intervention when they hit the water. The seven crew lost were Captain Accursio Gus Sanfilippo, Paul Beale and his son Paul Beale Jr., all of Gloucester, John Rosanitas and Sean Therian, both of Peabody, Freeman Short of the Scituate Marshfield area, and NOAA fishery observer Jada Samet of Rockport. State Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, Republican of Gloucester, outlined the investigation's three-phase approach and what he called a, quote, unprecedented effort to locate the Lilly Jean, during a press conference Wednesday with representatives of the agencies involved. There are multiple forms of investigation happening right now, and they are working in parallel. They are working in a complementary fashion, Tarr said. One will not obstruct or delay the other, and they will provide us with good information. One of the most haunting things about grief or loss at sea is not knowing, he said. Answering those questions requires a tremendous amount of effort. Governor Mara Healey echoed the enormity of the collaborative effort and called the seven lives lost the heart and soul of the fishing community. The way that we support the families is by standing with them and standing with this community, Healey said. The investigation's first phase was the initial search for the vessel. Following the sinking, the Coast Guard spent 27 hours on the water searching for the Lilly Jean, and while the vessel was not recovered, the body of Sanfilippo, an empty life raft and debris consistent with items that may float off of a deck were found. In the weeks since and currently, investigators are in phase two of the investigation. Tarr said this phase includes assessing data collected by the many involved parties. So far, investigators have learned the boat is approximately 350 feet underwater, and there is still a significant amount of topographical data to be analyzed before any firm conclusions can be reached. The topographical information was collected in searches on February 3rd and 4th and February 13th and 14th. The first search was conducted by the NOAA vessel Gloria Michelle, which came up from Woods Hole in Falmouth. Aboard the vessel was wide-scan sonar technology from the Environmental Police. The technology allowed investigators to create an initial topographical map of the ocean floor. Results of that mapping prompted the dispatch of NOAA's 208-foot survey vessel, Thomas Jefferson, a larger, more sophisticated version of the Gloria Michelle. Investigators are analyzing the data it recovered. According to John Hare, director of NOAA's Northeast Fisheries Science Center, investigators are looking at the map created by the Thomas Jefferson and comparing it to other ocean floor maps in hopes of finding, quote, anomalies or differences. The idea is that you'd be able to detect something on the bottom that's different from the topography of the area, Hare said. Depending on the results of what the Thomas Jefferson found, the state environmental police may use a remotely operated underwater vehicle to capture photographs of the anomalies, according to Environmental Police Colonel John Monahan. However, he said there needs to be very steady waters for the remotely operated underwater vehicle to capture good photographs because it is on a tether. The remotely operated underwater vehicle is something that we would send down just to look and see if something is what we think it is, Monahan said. In order to do that, we wait for calm seas, so that's what we're waiting for. Commander Brett Igo of the Coast Guard's Northeast District in Boston is the leading investigating officer. He said the goal moving forward for all investigating parties is to understand what happened and identify any measures that can be taken to improve the safety of life and property at sea. He said it could take months to get answers, and information will be released on a public website once it is available. Other investigating parties include the National Transportation Safety Board, an independent federal agency that investigates major marine tragedies, among other things. Marcel Muse, an NTSB marine accident investigator, said the organization is joining the Coast Guard in its effort by assisting in data collection and will produce its own independent report in the future. Phase 3 of the collaborative effort includes supporting the families of those lost at sea. The Gloucester Community Fishing Preservation Fund, a nonprofit that supports fishermen and their families, is collecting money for the Lily Jean's crew's families. Donations can be made at fvlilyjeanfund.org. Again, that's fvlilyjeanfund, that's all one word, .org. Or through Cape Ann Savings Bank at its branches at 109 Main Street, 38 Roger Street, and 4 Schoolhouse Road, all in Gloucester, and 247 Main Street in Rockport, and 117 Beach Street in Manchester by the Sea, or its website, capeandsavings.bank. I think it's probably capeandsavingsbank.com. And in a related story, grieving brother urges caution on speculation. It's written by Gail McCarthy. Rick Beale, the brother and uncle of two crew members lost at sea aboard the fishing vessel Lily Jean, spoke out at the end of a press conference held in Gloucester to provide an update on the investigation into the vessel's sudden sinking January 30th. I would like to express my gratitude to the Coast Guard and all the first responders and support groups for their efforts. Their dedication is unwavering. Bless you all. I'd like to thank the community for your support, which has been overwhelming. Thank you all. I'd like to condemn the faceless and in some cases evil speculation on social media. I beg you, in the name of decency, let us grieve in peace, he said at the Gloucester Harbormaster's office, packed with reporters, cameras, and other media. The facts are, this has been a terrible tragedy. We have lost a highly experienced and respected captain, a man ready to retire, and his son to whom he was going to pass the family torch, to three young men aspiring to join a fraternity of men generations in the making, and a young lady just beginning her journey through life, Beale said. Hopefully in the future, the investigation will give us some light on what happened, but as of now, only God knows what happened that fateful morning. Let us pray and cherish our memories of these seven souls. Beale is grieving the loss of his brother, Paul Beale, and his nephew, Paul Beale Jr. State Senate Minority Leader Bruce Tarr, who himself is grieving the loss of a friend, Captain Accursio Gus Sanfilippo, has cautioned others on spreading speculation on more than one occasion as the wounds of the grieving families are new. He also cautioned against such speculation because the investigation is still in its early stage with many agencies involved in the collection of data that needs to be analyzed. Also lost at sea were John Rossanitas, Freeman Short, Sean Therrien, and NOAA fishery observer Jada Samet. Tarr had another message to share. Remember that the people in our fishing fleet still are going out to sea every day. They're going out risking their lives to support their families. They're going out to bring back food to the table. They're out there right now. They will be out there tomorrow and the day after that, he said. I would just ask you, please do your best to consume some local fish. It's really important to us. And when you do, say a prayer for the person who got it to your plate. They're out there giving it their all, and in some cases, their very lives. Settlement attempt under seal. Officials to discuss options regarding the Atlantic Path in coming week. It's run by Stephen Hagan. Rockport. The future of the Andrews Point portion of the Atlantic Path was the subject of a confidential judicial settlement conference held in land court in Boston. The conference, a form of mediation, could still lead to a trial in the cases Fisher versus Commonwealth and Fisher versus Rockport, brought by Elizabeth Fisher of 18 Long Branch Avenue on Andrews Point. In dispute is whether the public has the right to use the section of the 1.5 mile path which runs along Rockport's northeast coastline from Halibut Point State Park to Cathedral Avenue that crosses Fisher's property. Friday's conference at the land court in the Suffolk County Courthouse in Boston included Fisher, her counsel, lawyers for the Massachusetts Attorney General, counsel for the town of Rockport, and select board members Donald Southard and Dwight Valentine. But the success or not of that conference is under wraps per an agreement signed by the participating parties. The select board released a statement Tuesday saying it will meet with town council during the coming week to discuss the cases and the conference. Town administrator Mitch Vieira and select board chair Paul Murphy said the town and the board would not have further comment beyond the statement due to the judge's impoundment order. As soon as the gag order is lifted, I would be happy to speak with you, Murphy said. Fisher reached by phone Wednesday, also said she could not comment on the case due to the judge's order. Before the order was issued, Murphy said the town's attorneys from KP Law would continue to advocate for the town. Rest assured that we are taking this matter extremely seriously, he said. The town intends to fight the Fisher case to the very end, using every resource available to us. Everyone involved is taking this matter seriously and acting with the responsibility the situation deserves. According to the board's statement, Judge Diane Rubin first met collectively with all the participants, introduced herself and her clerk, then described how she intended to proceed. She will serve to assist the parties in determining whether resolution of the cases might take place. The release further states that should the cases need to be resolved through trial, Rubin will not be the trial judge. The substance of any discussion elicited during the judicial settlement conference is confidential and cannot be shared with anyone not a party to the executed participation agreement and the ongoing conference, reads the statement. This principle of confidentiality is axiomatic in non-binding mediation and the alternative dispute resolution process, of which this judicial settlement conference is typical. During the conference, which reportedly lasted from 9:30 a.m. to 3:45 p.m., the parties and counsel went into separate rooms where they remained throughout. According to the statement, Rubin conferred with the different parties, repeatedly shuttling between each conference room and reviewing and discussing in detail the facts, the case litigation histories, and the respective positions of each party. Based on a controlling participation agreement, Rubin shall not share information from the settlement conference with the land court justice hearing this matter, except for limited procedural information and with the unanimous consent of the parties. Fisher bought her home in 1991 and moved to contest the public's right to use the path crossing her property, but a number of Rockport residents have said family members have used the path there and picnicked on Andrews Point for generations. A number of groups, including attorneys representing Fisher, a local group that has long maintained the right to walk the Atlantic Path, town officials, select board members, and Kendra Kinscherf of the Massachusetts Attorney General's Office have been involved in the dispute. More recently, Rockport residents, friends, and family members have taken Sunday walks along the coastal path, but their walks were eventually met by signs erected indicating the pathway was out of bounds. In 2022, the town reached an agreement with a Phillips Avenue property to move the property's portion, of the Atlantic Path further down the shoreline. And concluding the front page, The Curious Mind, A Journey of Discovery. It's written by Joanne McKenzie. Some say the curiosity killed the cat. Albert Einstein, on the other hand, said that, quote, curiosity is more important than intelligence. Gloucester's Anthony J. Marolda, who for many years has been sharing the ruminations of his own curious mind on the pages of this newspaper, has a few more words on the subject. It's a book called The Curious Mind. Rolda has a very curious mind, and armed with 2 degrees in physics from Northeastern University and a master's degree from Harvard, in The Curious Mind, he talks about everything from the existential threat of artificial superintelligence to animal intelligence, to quantum physics, to UFOs, to the metaverse, to extra exoplanets, to SpaceX's Starlink, to climate change, humanoid robots, genomics, 3D printed human organs, and time travel. Not to mention who really invented the light bulb, and it wasn't Edison. What began as a, quote, My View column, often read by this website, submitted to the Times in 2015, the year he and his wife Maria transitioned from summer to full-time residence in Annisquam, grew over years of subsequent submissions to what he calls 50 explorations into science and innovation. Rolda, an accomplished sailor, artist, local historian, and author, this is his 9th published book, says that his goal as a physicist is to make scientific learning accessible and understandable to everyone, or to be realistic, as understandable as is humanly possible. It helps that he is by nature remarkably plain-spoken and down-to-earth, amplifying his own observations with insights and running commentaries from the minds of dozens of the world's leading thought pioneers, scientists, physicists, and futurists, from the groves of academe to the campuses of Silicon Valley. Apart from anything else, this sort of extensively researched roundtable format keeps things lively for the reader as big brains from Elon Musk to Alan Turing weigh in on an encyclopedic range of topics. Will, for instance, a tsunami hit Cape Ann? Answer, not likely. The existential issue of the 21st century, Merolda tells us, is not climate change, but the rate at which artificial general intelligence is accelerating toward what physicists call singularity, the point at which superior data-driven digital intelligence renders human intelligence inferior. There are two schools of thought as to where this is leading us, utopia or dystopia. Merolda is inclined to lean toward utopia, but not without caution. Guardrails, he says, must be established now to safeguard against us, human beings, becoming redundant. At this point, such a thing seems like science fiction to the average human being, but then so did the iPhone just 30 years ago. Merolda, who was born in 1939 and remembers a world in which refrigerators replaced iceboxes, and television railroaded the radio out of the room, the speed with which modern technology has transformed that world is the indicator of how quickly it will continue to do so. And as for all those immense AI data warehouses cluttering up the American countryside and driving up energy demands and costs, no worry, says Merolda. There are already plans to send them up into space. It's not science fiction, he says. It's physics. You can read all about it in The Curious Mind. Ex-DOJ lawyers rip voter registration lawsuit. It's written by Christian Wade, Boston. A group of former Justice Department attorneys are urging a federal judge to dismiss a lawsuit by the Trump administration demanding that state officials turn over personal voter information ahead of the upcoming midterm election. The DOJ filed a lawsuit in December accusing Secretary of State Bill Galvin of violating federal voting access laws by refusing to provide a list of the state's registered voters, including addresses and partial Social Security numbers, to the agency for review. But a group of about 24 lawyers, all of whom previously worked for the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, filed a friend of the court brief on Tuesday, urging the judge to toss out the federal government's lawsuit. The attorneys said the DOJ has, quote, not provided any basis at all for thinking that Massachusetts might be violating federal statutes, much less a basis that would justify requesting sensitive voter data about all Massachusetts voters. And while DOJ has provided a purpose for its request, enforcing the NVRA and HAVA, that purpose appears to be a stalking horse for its true purpose, to enable the federal government to conduct its own list maintenance to discover whether non-citizens or undocumented immigrants are registered to vote, they wrote in the 27-page brief. That purpose cannot justify the request for sensitive data here. lawyers for the DOJ said in court filings that Galvin is violating the National Voter Registration Act, the NVRA that was mentioned, and Help America Vote Act by refusing to comply with the demands. The DOJ has asked a federal judge to force his office to turn over the information. The state attorney general's office, which is representing Galvin in the legal challenge, has asked the judge to dismiss the charges for lack of standing. The AG's office said the DOJ's lawsuit, quote, fails to meet the basic statutory requirements for requesting the voter registration data. Meanwhile, a coalition of voting rights and civil liberty groups, including Common Cause Massachusetts, the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, and other groups, have filed legal briefs siding with Galvin and asking the judge to dismiss the complaint. The push to pry open the state's voter rolls follows President Donald Trump's widely challenged executive order in March that called for new requirements to register to vote, along with a range of voting policies long supported by Republican lawmakers. To date, the DOJ has filed lawsuits against 23 states and the District of Columbia over their refusal to turn over the data. So far, two states, California and Oregon, have won court orders blocking the move while the legal challenge plays out. In most cases, the DOJ asked state election officials to turn over lists with voters' names, addresses, dates of birth, political party affiliation, phone numbers, driver's license numbers, and the last four digits of their Social Security numbers. They've also asked election officials to describe how they identify people who are convicted felons, deceased, or non-citizens, and the process of removing them from their voter lists. Galvin's office is also facing lawsuits filed by conservative groups who have made similar demands for access to voter information. Those legal challenges are part of a push by national groups challenging the legitimacy of large numbers of voter registrations. Scratch payouts lift lottery's January profit. It's written by Colin Young, Boston. Sales were down at the Massachusetts Lottery last month, but an almost equal drop in scratch ticket prizes claims helped the agency offset the decline and finish January with a greater profit than a year before. January sales of $543.8 million were down $23.4 million, or 4.1%, compared to January of 2025. Executive Director Mark William Bracken told the Lottery Commission on Tuesday morning. He said the lottery's monthly estimated profit was $98.7 million in January, compared to $95.4 million a year earlier. Assisting that dynamic was a $22.6 million drop in the number of scratch ticket grand prizes that players claimed in January. The lottery paid out $18.4 million on instant ticket grand prizes last month, compared to the much higher $41 million paid out in January of 2025, Bracken said. For all products, the lottery's prize payout percentage was 73.98% last month, compared to the much higher 76.02% in January of 2025. Through 7 months of fiscal year 2026, remember, the fiscal year runs from July 1st to June 30th. Through 7 months of fiscal year 2026, the lottery has done roughly $3.52 billion in sales. That's down $14.9 million, or 0.4%, compared to the same checkpoint in fiscal 2025 as the lottery dips behind last year's pace. Treasurer Deborah Goldberg told budget managers to expect the lottery to turn a net profit of $1.05 billion for fiscal 2026. I didn't know it was that much money. Money that lawmakers doled out to cities and towns as local aid. She said last week that the lottery is, quote, currently on track to meet its projection despite economic headwinds and continuing impacts from the competitive marketplace. Goldberg said the lottery projects flat retail sales in fiscal 2027 and therefore a flat net profit of $1.05 billion. Since the introduction of casino-style gambling here in 2015, Goldberg has been warning that the proliferation of gambling options could take a bite out of the lottery. Her long-sought iLottery is slated to go live this summer, estimated to bring in $70 million in net profit in the first year of operation. Net profit is expected to climb to $180 million for the third year of iLottery, 230 million in the fifth, and nearly 360 million in a decade in, Goldberg has said. We have time for a few letters to the editor. Tar will hit road running. There may never have been a candidate more qualified and ready for the job he seeks than Drew Tar, who is running for the seat left vacant by the death of his longtime mentor, boss, and friend, Representative Ann Margaret Ferranti. For 10 years, Drew was by Ann Margaret's side as her legislative aide, watching and learning how she got things done for Cape Ann. For the past 5 years of her illness, Drew stepped in to represent her at countless community events. He knows our communities, what our needs are, and how to help us at the State House. Drew will continue to fight for more affordable housing, better jobs, and quality education for our children. He will be a strong advocate for our fisheries and the associated waterfront activities, including the Gloucester Marine Genomics Institute, which Ann Margaret helped bring to life and strongly supported throughout her lifetime. Drew is known and respected at the State House. There will be no learning curve. He will be ready to go to work on day one for the people of Gloucester, Rockport, Manchester by the Sea, and Essex. Please support Drew Tar in the Democratic primary on March 3rd and the special election on March 31st. And it's written by Carolyn Stewart of Gloucester. Letters to the editor, election letter deadline. A special election primary for the seat held by the late Representative Ann Margaret Ferranti is March 3rd. The deadline for letters to the editor pertaining to the primary is Wednesday, February 25th. The final day election-related letters will be published is February 27th. No election letters will be printed in the Monday, March 2nd edition unless an urgent need arises to print a correction. Writers should confine endorsement letters to 250 words or fewer. All letters are subject to editing. The editor does not accept self-endorsements. The most effective, timely method for sending letters is via email to editor Andrea Holbrook at aholbrook@gloucestertimes.com. Thanks so much for listening. Please be sure to join us again tomorrow for another edition of the Gloucester Daily Times. Have a great day.